Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Well, good morning. Dan Perkins here. I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features the contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don?
Well, you know, Dan, the government spends an awful lot of money, federal, state, and local, and small businesses have often wanted to be part of that pie, but they've had difficulties having the patience that's required to receive government contracts. We have a really great guest on today, and I'd like you to introduce her.
Yeah, Don, today we have Lourdes Martin-Rosa from American Express Open Advisors, who specializes in government contracting.
Hello, Lourdes, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So we're excited to having you. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been at American Express, and a web address where people can get in touch with you about your services.
Yes, of course. So I'm actually a president of a small business that's an 8A small disadvantaged business, woman-owned, that's an actual government contractor myself. I've had the fortunate opportunity and to be honored to help craft a program with American Express called the American Express Open for Government Contracting Program that has been going strong for 9 years. And through this program, I actually get to have the throne of the American Express advisor in government contracting. And I'm actually like the walk the walk, talk the talk type person because I'm an actual government contractor myself. So I get to share pitfalls and good marketing tips to my fellow small business counterparts on how to grow their business as I have through the federal sector.
So what is the name of your business?
My company name is Government Business Solutions, and we actually provide different services to the federal government. We provide training services, we provide event management services, program management services, and of course administrative support services, which are among one of the top services that are purchased by the federal government. We also, I had the honor of receiving the Woman Advocate of the Year Award from Valerie Jarrett from the White House last year. I was very, very fortunate to receive that because, you know, through our program called the Challenge Her Program, which is a co-sponsorship with the Small Business Administration and an organization that's called WIP, Women Impacting Public Policy, and American Express, I've been able to touch thousands of women-owned small businesses out there on the importance of growing their business with government contracts.
So does your business have a website?
Yes. Actually, I'd like to revert you to the American Express Open Forum small business, and that would be openforum.com/government contracting,
mm-hmm.
because that's where other consultants like myself have provided a wealth of information. And actually, this is available for free to anyone that would like to go to this website. Again, it's openforum.com/government contracting. And they could download years and years of information that is very valuable to the growth of small businesses trying to learn how to do business with the federal government.
I tried to work with the Defense Construction and Supply Agency, part of the government out in Columbus, Ohio, and I gave up. The hoops that everybody had to jump through, the bidding process, I never could come up with a rationale of why I wanted to continue to put myself through that agony and not doing any business. So I'm sure that I'm not alone in that experience. I mean, we all see how slow the government works. As entrepreneurs, I'll speak for myself. I won't speak for you, but my guess is entrepreneurs basically have one speed, flat out all the time. That's why they're entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And how do you mesh the two cultures of flat out speed to the dramatic slows of working with the federal government?
And the dramatic slows is exactly what it is. The federal government is a slow-moving ship. It's not a fast-moving train at all. However, situations like yourselves where you were focusing on one government agency to develop and grow your infrastructure and your construction company, I would have suggested that you diversify and maybe go into other agencies because you always will run across those barriers. And sometimes as small businesses, what we tend to do, and I do this myself, is I tend to mirror that person's experience or my experience with that agency across all agencies. And we have to understand that all this is a huge monster of the federal government, and they spend approximately about $500 billion a year. Each agency is run as if its own company. So I would have advised you to go to a different agency and perhaps market yourself there. But for small businesses, and I want to talk about an American Express survey that we recently did, is we showed that active federal contractors reported spending of about $148,000 up last year from an analysis that was done in 2013 where the average was about $126,000. Also, we also noticed that the cost of doing business with the federal government rose approximately about 15% over the past 3 years. So is it getting tougher for small businesses to do business with the federal government? In my opinion, I believe so. However, I think that we have to be savvier. I think that we have to utilize some of the resources that we have from the Small Business Administration and also from build relationships with the small business specialists within each agency, because those are your strongest advocates. And in my experience, for example, and I'll give you a hands-on experience that we just recently had, as event managers, I noticed a opportunity coming up in an agency's procurement forecast. So all federal agencies must have posted, as of 2013, the SBA gave them a directive, that they all must have their procurement forecast, which is a forecast of what they're going to be purchasing in the next coming months or the next coming year or two. And you could basically prepare your marketing strategy with that agency, because now you are talking to them about an opportunity that is going to happen, that is not out there yet. It's not posted. It's not public knowledge. You're actually doing the digging, and you're actually going in there and building that relationship with that contracting official, that small business specialist. And that's the way that savvy small business owners are learning how to capture these government contract opportunities before they're posted.
Now, I want to go back to something you said a few moments ago, because I wasn't quite clear of what you were reporting. So I apologize if you said it. I didn't hear it. You gave two numbers. I think the second number was 146,000.
Yes.
Was that the number of?
It's about an average of. It's an average. I'm sorry. It's an average about $148,000 that it will cost. Active government contractors are reported spending annually on government contracts. Also, they reported submitting about an average of 18 prime contracts annually, which is the numbers are about right. And also the circle of receiving an award from that first time that you start tapping into that government agency, according to American Express surveys, the average is about 18 months. So for a small business that has to do with payroll, and those bills are knocking on our doors on a daily basis, it's very difficult for us to be able to scale and to be able to market to this federal sector given those time frames.
Do you have a sense?
So
I'm sorry. Do you have a sense of how many small businesses do business with the federal government?
Oh, there are thousands of businesses that do business with the federal government. I know that I recently participated in a four-hour roundtable setting with the SBA, and I was very honored to be invited, and learned that the women's procurement program is in a revamp process, and the SBA is actually improving opportunities for women. Women are becoming one of the fastest-growing entrepreneurs now, and growing at a very fast rate. So the Women's Procurement Program was born in February 2011, with it then being revamped and improved in 2013, and even more improvements were done last year, with it now almost being at parity with all the other small business programs. So I could tell you that there are a little bit under 90,000 women registered to do business with the federal government. So when you look at those parameters, you say, wow, that's a lot of women. But not really when there's about $17 billion approximately that's up for grabs to these women-owned contractors annually. I don't want competition, but however, I think that women need to step up to the plate and take advantage of this opportunity, of this problem that the government is having of not finding women-owned small business contractors. And for our fellow male counterparts, I think that it would be advantageous to them to perhaps seek a women-owned teaming partner to be able to grow together.
There are, I want to put this the right way, I don't want to sound bigoted. Are you saying that the federal government in the procurement process has approximately $17 billion worth of contracts for women-owned businesses only?
So if you take, and that's an approximation, because if you take what the federal government spends annually, anywhere between $450 and $500 billion, and you 5% of the goal set aside for women, and last year there was approximately about $17 billion that was awarded to women-owned small businesses, and they met and surpassed that 5% goal for the first time. So that was a huge celebration for women business owners across the board and the SBA.
There are procurement provisions in the federal government for minority-owned businesses, and there's a certain percentage of the contracts have to go to minority-owned businesses, and only minority-owned businesses, and I would assume what you're saying, there's a goal of 5% of that $500 billion they want for women-only owned businesses. So that is the government through these allocations based on either race or sex, picking and choosing who they want to do business with, regardless of whether or not the people are qualified?
So let's talk about that. The federal government, and let's go on a round number of $500 billion because it's an easy number to use, 23% of those expenditures annually must be set aside to small businesses. So if we slice that pie a little further, 5% should go to firms that are small disadvantaged businesses, and minorities could fall under this category, and also 8A certified businesses, which are small disadvantaged businesses. And then the other slice of the pie is 5% for women-owned small businesses. Then you slice it even further, 3% for service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses, and then another 3% for businesses that are located in hub zone areas. Those are called historically underutilized business zones. So as a small business, when you take these programs that are already out there, I would say gain a competitive edge in government contracting and see if where you would be able to qualify for any of these programs. While the Small Disadvantaged Business Program does allow some minorities to be able to qualify, it is not considered a minority program. It is considered a small disadvantaged program. And the women-owned program, 51% of the companies need to be owned and operated by women-owned businesses. But one of the programs that is strongly getting traction is the Hub Zone program, which is the historically underutilized business zone. Firms could actually go to the SBA website, which is called sba.gov/hubzone, H-U-B-Z-O-N-E, and just basically put in their zip code and find out if their headquarter company is located in any hub zone area. And you'd be surprised. It's not just areas that are impoverished. Some areas that are near universities or near large community colleges are sometimes considered low income because of the debt-to-income ratio with the students. So, for example, Georgetown, which is a beautiful part of town, there
right.
are certain areas of Georgetown which are hub zones.
Right.
And what we suggest to these businesses is to definitely take advantage of these resources.
Right. Let me ask you a question specifically focusing in on women, because I think it's a fascinating subject. And maybe you don't have any data, or maybe you can give us some of your gut instinct. What kind of, if I have a woman out there who's unhappy with her job and she doesn't feel like she's got much opportunity and she's making a modest salary and she's thinking about starting her own business, and she's thinking about starting a business that can get involved with the government, you wisely just counseled us a few moments ago that it may take as much as 18 months before you can get your first opportunity. What kind of businesses would be ideal for that single mom or somebody interested in a female interested in starting a business? Where is their greatest opportunity for success?
One of the fastest growing women-owned small businesses are actually those that are in the professional administrative and management consulting. So these are firms that provide administrative support, kind of like your temp agencies, where if you figure we have a new administration, there is a shift in language, there is a shift in personnel. What's the easiest way to fulfill that shift is to basically hire a temp to be able to do the work for you. So a woman-owned small business that has had past performance in the corporate sector, or they don't want to wait those 18 months and maybe they could tap into doing business with the federal government as a subcontractor, could basically consider opening up her firm to begin to do business with the federal government. One of the things that I would definitely suggest to women-owned small businesses is that to obtain their self-certification through the SBA's portal, the Small Business Administration portal, because you want to be able to have that certification, attached to your company when you're talking to government officials, because that will be able to validate that the lady is an active woman-owned small business.
Lourdes, I'd like to ask you a question. How does a woman become certified? What is the process?
We actually, in openforum.com/government contracting, women that want to learn how to become self-certified, we have an insight guide that will help guide ladies on how to do that. But also, the SBA actually just created a new website called certify.sba.gov, and it's for all certifications. But they could actually go on there, and it's an easy step-by-step process. I would say to my lady counterparts to basically do this when they're not interrupted, because it may take you about an hour to upload information into that WOSB repository. But, you know, and you always want to be focused on the information that you are uploading. You're not going to receive a certificate. You're not going to receive anything that says you are now WOSB certified, nothing but an email from the SBA GLS system, just basically letting you know that you are now in the repository. Then it's really up to us to go into the procurement forecast of the federal agencies and look at those opportunities that are coming up that are not posted yet that may be set aside WOSB for women-owned small business. But I would like to mention also that American Express Open came, conversely, basically came up with, in the survey that says that women-owned federal contractors have continued to spend less time and money in seeking federal contracts. Although the opportunities are there for women, as I mentioned, they're not stepping up to the plate. They reported that women invested an average of about $107,000 in seeking federal contracting opportunities in 2015. Just 58% of the amount invested of men-owned firm, which is an average of $170,000. So I think that women need to consider the federal government as a good, viable customer.
So if I heard you correctly, Lourdes, you're saying you have to spend about $100,000 by the time it's finished to earn in costs before you earn your first contract. Did I hear that right?
According to the key findings from a survey among active federal contractors that American Express did, they did notice that women-owned firms were reported investing about an average of $107,000. In seeking federal contracting opportunities. Now let's take that. Let's consider what those expenditures might be. It would probably be someone that would help out with proposal writing, hiring an SME that's an expert in a particular agency, or maybe even a business development individual that you may want to hire to help you, market your company to these federal agencies.
Hmm. Having worked in this area a long time, and we're coming towards the end of our time together, I can tell you that finding someone within the Washington Beltway to help you is oftentimes the best and quickest way of getting a government contract. In two instances where I've been involved, that's been the case.
Yes, and I think that you are definitely right. Some of our AVID partners are those that sit in the small business development centers or the procurement technical assistance centers. The PTAC centers or procurement technical assistance centers are usually funded by DOD, whereas the small business development centers are usually funded by SBA and other co-sponsorships. You may find some of these in your local universities, and these are great advocates for us. They know the landscape of the cities or states that they represent, and they are there to help us and provide us free information. I do also want to say that the American Express Open Government Contracting Program has been very strong for the last 9 years. I've had the honor of being their advisor in government contracting. And this year we're celebrating our 9th annual DC Summit. I can't express what a valuable program and event this is for small businesses, where small businesses will have a chance to sit in breakout sessions, everything on how to market to the government, what government agencies are expecting for small businesses, how to become certified, but also a matchmaking session that's called Contract Connections with over 60 or so federal buyers, and the cost is free. So it's a free event that American Express Open is hosting for small businesses, and we collaborate with our friends from the Small Business Administration. It's going to be held June 15th And if they, our listeners, go to the openforum.com government contracting page, they'll be able to see the event. It is June 15th at the beautiful Marriott Marquis in the D.C. Summit, and it's a free event. Last year, we had a little bit over 800 small businesses attend. This year, we're anticipating at least 1,000 attendees, and it's a great honor to have American Express Open actually host an event like this for free to small businesses.
Well, I was going to say thank you so much for being with us. It's been illuminating. Dan, why don't you have the final word?
Yeah, please tell us again the preferred website that you would like people to go to.
That would be openforum, openforum.com/government contracting. They could download a wealth of information there for free.
Thank you so much, Lourdes, for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use BISCOM's secure file transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit BISCOM.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
So we're back, and our next guest is Kenneth Groenbeck. Did I get that right, Ken? Is it Groenbeck?
Yep. Well, actually, it's Groenbeck. You can't make a mistake.
Well, I did, obviously. I apologize. Ken is a really smart guy, and he's going to talk to us about demographics. So, Ken, tell us a little about yourself, your company, and how can our listeners get in touch with you if they want to see if you can help them.
Okay. I'm a demographer. People ask me all the time, what's a demographer? And my daughter's in the backseat of our car when she was 15 years old, and her friend leaned over and said to her, what does your dad do? You know, I'm invisible. I'm driving the car. And my daughter said, he's a demographer. And the friend said, you know, she thought for a moment. She said, kind of an astute answer. She said, is that like an accountant or an economist? And my daughter looked at her, and she said, no. Accountants and economists count money and stuff. My dad counts people, and people are more important than money and stuff. So I said, yeah, good answer. I'm using that from now on. That's what I do. I count people. I count populations. I look at live births. I look at migration, and I look at deaths. And using demographic information, I can make very, very accurate forecasts about markets, political phenomena, consumer, you know, consumption, tax paying, you name it. So that's what I do.
Okay, so you got a website where we can get a hold of you?
Yeah, it's called kgcdirect.com. kgcdirect.com.
We'll
all kinds of information there. One of the things that I do is, as I'm a keynote speaker, I speak 50, 60 times a year. I speak all over the United States. So I get to have real good contact with all sectors, everything from healthcare to government to plastics to candy, everything.
Wonderful. Well, we'll put your website up on our website next to your interview.
Cool.
We haven't talked before, so you don't know what I'm going to say. And I'm fascinated with your subject matter because I'm not a demographer, but I spend a lot of time studying statistics. I want to ask you a question specifically about demographics. And based on just that, the facts that I'm going to give you, I'll be interested from a demographer standpoint what it tells you. Okay?
Sure.
Black people represent approximately 13% of the population of the United States. Yet they account for 33% of all the abortions performed in the United States. In New York City and many other major metropolitan areas across the United States, the number of abortions in the black community exceeds the life births on an annual basis. Now, I know that's not a lot of statistics, but what does it tell you?
Tells you the black culture is in trouble, and that's kind of a hardball question, but I'll be straight with you. I tell folks this all the time. most of the audiences I speak to are, it looked like honky heaven. They're all white people. And so I wonder what's happening with the black culture. The black culture, while it according to Pew Research, is off the bottom rung socioeconomically, and the bottom rung in the United States now is primarily held by Latinos, Mexican Latinos, because they're essentially the last immigrants in. The black culture is in trouble because the black culture essentially aborts as many children as they have. Mm-hmm. And in Manhattan, which is a figure that you know, I believe you just cited,
right.
it exceeds their number of live births.
Right.
It's very, 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 it's extremely unhealthy.
I have talked. I was a civil rights activist many, many years in the late 70s in desegregation of the schools in the Midwest, and I have continued some contacts, and I have. A number of people. I worked recently this past year for a black gentleman who was running for Congress in Louisiana, and in my first discussion with him, he was actually on our show, and I talked to him about the genocide that the black community is putting on itself. And again, numbers. If we look at the number of abortions since we had legalizations of abortion and Roe v. Wade, the number of black abortions would have been equal to about 28 congressional seats that were lost. And I look at what's going on at the genocide that's taking place in Chicago and in Philadelphia and Baltimore with the black-on-black crime. It's almost as if the black race is trying to destroy itself purposely.
Yeah, you know, give you another statistic. There are 2 million people in jail, 2 million men in jail. The million African Americans, half a million whites, and a half a million Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
They're 13% of our total population. They're 50% of our people that are in prison in
mm-hmm.
jail. What the heck is that? What we're doing in the United States is we are dealing with. First of all, it's not politically correct to even discuss this, and I'll give you credit for that.
Doesn't bother us.
Oh, good for you. Well, I'm glad because you know what I do. My latest book called Upside came out last week. It should have come out last year, and the reason it didn't come out is because the publisher, when I submitted the manuscript, said we can't publish this. And I said why? She said it's not politically correct. And I said, what are you talking about? It's exactly the same style as my book that you made a zillion dollars on from in 2008. My book, The Age Curve, and she said that was then. This is now. And I said, so we can't talk about these things. And she said, no. I said, they're statistics. They're numbers. It's like objectivity. It's truth. You can't. What are you talking about? So when I asked my audiences, I said, do you mind if my presentation is not politically correct? They cheer.
Yeah.
So I salute you.
Well,
you're on the right program, Kenneth.
I thank you. I believe that. Political correctness actually is counterproductive to letting the truth be known. And
yeah.
I think that that's the problem that's happened in Europe. I mean, we have the Swedish government saying that there's no problem as they're blowing up train stations and murdering their people. The political
yeah.
correctness of Europe has caused its downfall.
You want some numbers there?
Sure,
please.
Here's what's going to happen. This is what's happening around the world. There's this wonderful statistic called replacement level fertility. Replacement level fertility is a little over 2 kids per couple. In 1964, and you won't read this in any history books, in 1964, half of the women in the world dropped below replacement level fertility. That means we're having many fewer kids, fewer kids, fewer kids, fewer kids. Europe, the fertility in Europe, you're starting in Portugal, Spain, France, go all the way through Eastern Europe into Russia. No babies, no babies, no babies. You need labor, you got to bring it in from someplace. Where's the labor coming from? The labor is coming in from North Africa. Now you have a conflict in your cultures. And the conflict in the cultures in a republic is interesting because you don't need to have a big percentage of a minority to insist on public policy, and that's what's happening. You're seeing public policy is going to change, especially relative to dress and especially relative to women in the EU. So what's going to happen? Well, they're going to bail. And where are they going to go? They're coming here. We're going to see an influx from Europe based on demographic issues, and falling way below replacement level fertility is going to change everything. You know where the lowest fertility is in all of Asia? It's in South Korea. South Korea will not be a country in 50 years because they simply will not have enough taxpayers.
Period. And I've recently, the Chinese government has said that their one-child policy, which they put in many, many years ago, now they're
1979. It was a policy failure. Under 37 years old right now in China, they're missing 500 million people.
Right.
Now, a country is run on it's heavy lifters. Now, the heavy lifters pay the tax that runs, that cares for the young, cares for the old, and runs the country.
Mm-hmm.
China is 20 years away from having no heavy lifters.
Oh, and an enormous amount of debt. Let me move on to another, in the same church but a different pew. I believe that historically, we have treated black people in this country as what I call the protected class. They were are the protected class of the Democratic Party, and therefore, the Democratic Party, in order to keep them in a position of influence, have spent enormous amounts of money. The war on poverty under Lyndon Johnson so far has spent about $22 trillion and hasn't dramatically changed the life of black people. But I believe there's a new protected class in the United States, which you didn't mention. I think the protected class in the United States right now is the Muslim population.
Yeah. Well, the Muslim population in the United States is about 1%. So I wouldn't worry about it. And the biggest problem in the Muslim population right now is as soon as they come into the country, and if they assimilate and their kids go to public school, then there's a conflict within the families. It could be. I think you could say that, but it's such a tiny, tiny number. It's not one that as a demographer I'm concerned about.
Yeah. Well, we do a Tuesday afternoon show, and one of our co-hosts is Iraqi, and he's he is very concerned about the political correctness what's going on in Europe and in the United States as it relates to Muslims. One of the things, and you could help me on this if I'm off base, and all I have in this particular example is anecdotal information, and that is that the Muslim population are more prolific in terms of births than most of the other populations in the world.
In the EU, that is correct.
Yeah. So let's move. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah. Can I jump in? This program's about small business, and we have to invite him on one of our other programs because
sure.
I think he has a lot to say.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth, let's talk about demographics in terms of small businesses. Do you have any insights as to what small businesses should be looking at in terms of demographics? For instance,
sure.
Should they be? The floor is yours, Ken.
Well, here the best example I can give you. What is the single biggest entity enemy of small business in the United States is Walmart. True?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Walmart's in trouble. Walmart's a baby boomer based business. They base their business on the people that were born 1945 to 1964.
Mm-hmm.
They saw 20 years of same store sales increases based on baby boomers because they didn't have to offer selection. All they had to do was offer two or three items in a category and beat up the supplier so bad that they could offer the lowest price and then employ people that had to be subsidized by the government. So Walmart is not a friend of small business. Right now, the baby boomers' consumption levels have dropped like a stone because once you crest 50, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, your consumption of stuff it drops dramatically. So boomers are 53 to 72 years old. So they're moving on. So the same store sales for Walmart, especially in the United States, is going to force – them to close stores. And all the categories inside of Walmart's are going to be opportunities for small business to jump in and take a piece.
But, Ken, I'm a registered investment advisor, and I manage money, been managing money for 43 years. And one of the phenomenons that I've been watching for the last year and a half is, setting aside your Walmart example, look at the other big box stores in malls and shopping centers that are totally going out of business or have moved their entire business model to the internet. The big box store is not going to survive. And one of my daughter-in-laws works for a major real estate developer in New Jersey, and they're taking some strip malls and they're virtually tearing them down and converting the space to senior housing.
How about that?
Because they've got vacant buildings that are doing nothing. But I'm curious about your statistic about what's going on. We are a nation that is consuming less, that we are less consumption driven than we perhaps were in our younger years. What are you seeing about the next generation, the millennials? What are they doing?
Well, we have what they call a barbell economy, a barbell demography, which means we have big heavyweights at both ends. Boomers are currently 53 to 72 years old. There's about 80 million of them. There's still 80 million of them. They're not. They're about 3 or 4 years away from absolutely devastating health care, elder care, and death care. They're going to get caught flat-footed. They're going to get hit by a tsunami. At the other end of the spectrum, you have their kids. Now, and again, I'm speaking macro now, 30,000 feet. Their kids are born 1985 to 2004. They're called millennials. They're called Gen Y. There's 86 million of them. They're bigger than the baby boomers by at least two birth years. They've been kept out of the labor market because their baby boomer parents couldn't leave it because they couldn't access the equity in their homes. But now that's all changing, and boomers are leaving. I'm in Florida right now. In season, you wait three turns to get through a light because of the number of people that are down here and the number of people that are coming here. So what's going to happen is the consumption levels of this 86 million people who are currently 13 years old to 32 years old is really not known. But if they consume at all at the levels relative to what they did in their when they were growing up, it's going to turn the consumption of the United States on its ear as they form households and get married.
Yeah. I live on Sanibel Island in southwest Florida, from out in the Gulf of Mexico from Fort Myers. And season is November 1st to May 1st.
Yep.
Non-season, the population of the island is about 6,000 people. During season, especially peak season in the 1st of February, it swells to 30,000 people.
Yep.
And we don't have any traffic lights. They're not allowed by local statute.
I'm in Bonita Springs.
Yeah, I know. I know Don wants to ask the question, but let me just jump in with one more thought to bring us back to our situation on recalculating for small business. What do you think, as a demographicer, what do you think is the one of the best, or several, if you want to do that, of the best business ideas that make sense to you today where there's opportunity to grow and build a successful business?
There's three as far as I'm concerned. Anything to do with setting up households is going to do very, very well, because the number of Gen Y that are going to get married is going to stagger the industry. It's going to stagger everything to do with weddings. It's going to stagger everything to do with the venues for receptions. And then apartments and houses. Get this now. We did the math on this, and we've done the math conservatively. We currently are 25 million housing units short of our needs. Either these kids are going to sleep on the ground in tents and sleeping bags, or we're going to have to build structures. That's one end of the spectrum.
Are there parents' basements, whatever? Go ahead.
Well, what they're doing is they're taking all the trophies that they didn't deserve and taking them to the dump, and they're moving out.
Okay.
So at the other end of the spectrum, you have health care, elder care, and death care. You want to get into a good business? Those three. The one that normally gets a laugh in my presentations is death care, because there simply are not enough funeral homes, there simply are not enough crematoriums, and there isn't enough space in cemeteries to handle boomer volume.
I happen to agree with you. In my client's investment portfolio, and I'm not going to mention the name on the air because it's not appropriate to do that, but I, several years ago, said, you know, as the boomers age, there's going to be an increasing demand for cemeteries, crematoriums, whatever, funeral homes, and I bought this company, and I think longer term, it's one of those things that you don't want to, people get a little crazy about buying, but when you get paid a very attractive yield and you've got a growth opportunity, you have to set all of that aside. So dying, building new houses, weddings, and funerals.
Yep.
Anything else?
Anything that Walmart sells. Go back to Walmart. Take a look at the categories inside of Walmart. The things that are going to fail first in Walmart, the categories that they're probably going to downsize or remove from their big boxes, would be a good thing to copy. So that would be my advice. Hey, listen, while I've got you here, I want you to write down another website. This is another website that is mine, okay? It's called Advisor Revolution. Now, there are two R's, and it's all one word, advisorrevolution.com. Take a look at it.
Okay. Don?
Two things. Kenneth, you have a new book out, tell us the name of the book and where people can get it.
Okay, it's available in all bookstores. It's called Upside, Profiting from the Profound Demographic Shifts Ahead. It is extremely positive, and it's not blowing smoke. This is all based on objectivity, numbers. The United States is the only world power. The United States is the only industrialized nation that has a crop of kids called Gen Y. We have a labor force that's waiting in the wings to boost manufacturing here in the United States like never before, which is why you're going to see it all come back from China.
Can I ask you a question about that? Because it's an important issue. We have – I'm sorry, Don. I apologize. We have
no, we're
90 –
No, we're both going to ask the same question. You've got
sure
to expand on this.
we have 96 million people unemployed in the United States or underemployed. And they're not all retirees. Is that part of what you're talking about, the reserve force that we could bring to bear on bringing people to the marketplace?
Yeah, that's part of it. That the actual if the people are unemployed between the ages of 30 and 50, that's another story. We have a labor. I'm talking about a labor force of 86 million young people aged right now 13 to 32.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Gen Y. It's the largest generation ever born in the United States. And I think it's the best generation ever born. And if I hear one more person say that, you know, they don't want to work, they're too lazy, well, please, listen, I grew up when they were hippies. What happened to the hippies? They grew up and faced responsibility and disappeared. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Don.
But what kind of work will they be doing? And you say bringing back from China. What do you mean by all of that, Kenneth?
I mean manufacturing. I mean, listen, what is you know what the productivity, per capita contribution to GDP in China is about $8,000. In the United States, it's $60,000. We have not been at their level of productivity since the Civil War. The productivity in the United States is very, very high. And as things become more and more high-tech, as this new generation consumes more high-tech, as we have cars that drive themselves, as we have, you know, there'll be planes that fly themselves, all of the demand for that level of sophistication is going to come out of our population. And people ask me from time to time, they say, well, what about the robots? They're going to replace people. No, we're going to need both. We're fine. Don't worry about it.
See, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Don. Finish.
No, you first. Go ahead, Dan.
I've been studying China for a long, long time. The debt to GDP ratio, it shows the strength or lack of strength of a particular economy. In the United States, our debt to GDP, meaning the entire amount of our gross domestic product as a percentage of our outstanding debt at the government level, it's about 104. The GDP to debt ratio in China is 2.4 times. In addition, which is disastrous, they have to import 60% of their oil and 40% of their coal. So they are a net importer of energy, and they cannot create enough energy on their own. It seems to me that we have an advantage now because we have released the ability of American energy companies, which could create tremendous jobs. We have a chance very quickly to become the largest exporter of crude oil and coal around the world to millions and millions of people in hundreds of markets. The cost of energy may be cheaper in the United States than any place else in the world, and I think that's part of the reason why people might want to come back to the United States and bring manufacturing back. In addition to, if Mr. Trump is successful in his corporate taxes, those two things alone could spur a tremendous amount of relocation and redistribution of manufacturing.
I think what you're going to see, guys, and I don't know if we're on the same page or not, but this is my basic take on the United States. I think you're going to see a spike in the economy. It's not going to look back for 20 years, and I'll be dead, so I don't care.
But what's the spike going to come from?
Housing. Housing is the economy. The economy is housing, just that alone. We need 25 million new houses, 25 million new housing structures. That means everything. When you build houses, you need dish soap. You need brooms.
Where are you going to get the land to do this?
Where are you going to get the land? What are you talking about?
Yes. If people want I'm not arguing with Kenneth, but a question that just came across my computer asks, if people want to live near transportation, et cetera, rather than out in the suburbs, where are you going to find the land?
Listen, if you wanted to have everybody in the world, all 7 billion people, live with the same density as Manhattan Island, what state you could put them in? Texas. If you wanted to have all 7 billion people come to a party at your house, and you wanted to give them 6 square feet so they could dance, you could have your party in Rhode Island. There's plenty of land. Don't worry about land.
Well, I agree with you. I think the idea that that this whole urbanization, when I came to Florida, we were visiting friends and they were living in a condo, and I've lived in a single family home almost my entire life. And I went around looking at 650 square feet, one bedroom, two bedrooms, bath and a half. And I said, this is not life. This is not life. I can't do this. We wound up buying a house and then sold it and bought a bigger house. So, how are we doing on time, Don?
Well, we've got four more minutes, and I'd like to hear some more of what Kenneth – give us some more stats, Kenneth. You and Dan are really going at it, so please, some more.
Yeah. Let me ask you a quick question, Ken.
Yeah.
What's the demographics of the Democratic Party look like to you?
It sucks.
Is it basically dead?
Well, here, I'll give you some numbers on that. We lose a Republican every 16 seconds because they die. Conservatives, people that are old tend to be conservatives. Again, macro, big picture, 30,000 feet. We gain a new Democrat every 8 seconds because they come of age to vote. Hillary should have won this last election in flying colors. I mean, she absolutely wiped out every pollster that I know, with the exception of John Zogby, who wrote the foreword for my book. He's a genius, and he got it right. But number-wise, the Democrats have super numbers, but they're all, they're ideologically, they're all over the place.
Do you think that the Democratic tent is going to collapse on them?
No.
Because they have so many different factions?
No, I think... Thank God. You know, I tell folks this. You know, a lot of folks are worried about Trump being in the White House. And I said, well, okay, you can have your opinion about him. I have mine. I said, but the presidency is bigger than the president, and the republic is bigger than the presidency. We're going to be fine. And I said, and you're worried about political factions and people fighting all the time and not getting anything done? I said, what you don't want is you don't want your politicians getting along. They get along great in Russia. They get along great in North Korea. We don't want that.
What do you think is going to happen in the election this weekend in Paris?
That's a good question. I I have a feeling. I'm trying to think of what's the woman's name?
Le Pen.
Yeah, I get a feeling she's gonna win.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Well, you don't need the macaroon.
I'm just telling you numbers wise because, you know, I have a friend in who lives in Paris, and he said, "Ken, we have to leave." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I can't go to the park anymore. I can't go to the park without being accosted and told that I have to cover my little girl up."
Right. What about Merkel in Germany?
Well, she's dug herself a hole. I mean, you know, she's kind of like spearheaded this whole immigration issue, and I think it could blow up in her face.
Why do you think, Ken, why do you think in Britain, the United States, in Belgium recently, in France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Portugal, why do you think consistently all the governments and the elites missed what the common man was saying?
I think it has something to do with not understanding that political correctness is a danger. It's a...
Okay.
I don't know. I don't get it. Listen, you know what Voltaire said? Voltaire said, "Common sense is not so common." Mm-hmm. And in the first book that I wrote called "Common Senses," with a C E N S U S, was these are numbers. I mean, do the numbers. Just do the numbers. The numbers don't lie. The numbers are real. The numbers are objective. You know, get your subjectivity out of this, and get political correctness out of this, and make your decisions based on the truth,
yeah.
And you make much, much better decisions.
We're almost out of time. I have one more question for you, Ken.
Sure.
Well, I have one too.
Okay, so Don gets the last question. What is your sense of the role in women going forward globally?
Well, in the United States, first of all, law school, it's almost all women now. And then in college, it's like 70-30 women. So women are going to lead because they're going to be they will pass their less educated counterparts. So long term, 20-30 years, you're going to see women leading in all categories, including CEOs of major companies.
Okay. Don?
I'll ask this question then. What figures do you have on women small business owners? Is it growing
It's growing dramatically. Well, because I think women are finding themselves, and I wholeheartedly encourage them to do so. I think they're going to make wonderful leaders. I think they're going to make wonderful business people. I encourage them to go into business for themselves because that's how you change things, because it immediately circumvents all of the biases. I think small business and women are a natural. So go for it.
Well, I think we're out of time.
We are, but tell us once again your book and how people can reach you.
Okay, my website is kgcdirect.com. The new book, which you can get on Amazon or you can buy it at Barnes & Noble, is Upside, Profiting from the Profound Demographic Shifts Ahead. Upside.
Well, Kenneth, it's obvious you have to come back to this program. Dan's enjoying you too much, and so am I.
Thanks for coming. We enjoyed it.
Yeah, and you guys take care.
Thank you. And now a word from our sponsor.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Well, Dan, we missed your commentary today, but we certainly had two very interesting guests.
Mm-hmm.
Any very quick 10-second comments you want to make before the program ends?
I think the young lady we talked to gave us a lot of insight of what's happening, the opportunities of women in small business. And Ken said, great opportunity for women in small business. So we did our job today. It's time to go.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.